Welcome to BridgeEd, the podcast brought to you by The Bridge here at Wellington College, where we'll be joined by a series of interesting guests to explore some of the most topical issues in the education sector.
I'm so happy to be here with you today, Eoin Crisfield. We've known each other for a long time, and I'm a great admirer of your work. So I'm really excited today to be able to share more widely some of your thinking and your experience and your research on teaching to multilingual learners, but also multilingualism in the context of inclusive classrooms. So tell us all about it.
Well, I'm delighted to be here with you too. We always have good conversations, so it's nice to have a good conversation that we can share. I mean, I think that our evolving understanding of the experiences of multilingual learners in schools kind of dates back to, you know, the 1970s. And it's been a journey of understanding that while in many ways we often prioritize the learning of English as kind of the key indicator of success, that the experience of being a multilingual learner in a school with a diverse background, both linguistically and usually then, of course, also culturally, brings a richness to the classroom that we don't often tap into, but also brings a different set of perspectives and is in and of itself a characteristic that needs to be known and understood and protected apart from our kind of key focus of helping them learn English. It's also about the deeper piece of how does multilingualism enhance our classroom learning experiences for all of our students, whether they are themselves multilingual or monolingual.
Okay, so what makes it difficult sometimes? What's challenging for teachers in tapping into that background, that richness that students bring to the classroom?
I think it depends. You know, different teachers will have different kind of barriers, but a lot of times teachers see themselves as tasked to help our multilingual students learn English. And so if my key job is to help them learn English because we know that their proficiency in English is the strongest predictor of their academic success, we focus on that piece and our kind of professional role as supporting them learning English. It's also the case that there are many, many multilingual children in classrooms with monolingual teachers. And so monolingual teachers may not have a sense that they themselves have the expertise to understand and support multilingualism. It can feel quite intimidating, the idea of having kids in your classes who can speak languages that you don't speak, and the idea of trying to figure out what to do with that requires teachers to kind of be a little bit vulnerable and become learners along with their students and be open to students experiencing things that they can't necessarily fully access. And that's a big leap of faith for a lot of teachers, that kind of giving over of some of the control of our classrooms to students doing work in their own languages, sharing their own languages, you know, reading things in their own languages. And so I think it's not ever one thing. It's sometimes just that kind of core understanding that our job is to teach them English, and sometimes a little bit of hesitation around, well, I don't speak their languages. How would I be able to support them effectively?
So it's a leap of faith, but in some respects, it can also be a leap of imagination. You might not even imagine that that is something that's possible. And I think you know that I've long been interested in this question of teacher vulnerability and the professional stance in the classroom and trying to find ways to help teachers embrace that uncertainty and really enter into a space of the co-construction of knowledge. And modeling vulnerability is one of the ways in which we, I think, create a safe space for children.
I completely agree, but different education systems obviously have different understandings of the role of students and teachers. And in some systems, it's much easier for teachers to take a step back from their authority in the classroom and look at co-constructing knowledge and co-constructing understanding. In education systems that are a bit higher control, that can feel like a bigger step, where if the expectation is that the teacher is the authority, saying, I don't know the answer to that, or tell me how to say it in your language, I've never heard that before, can feel like a giving away of authority. Mm. It doesn't have to be, but I've definitely met lots of teachers who have that kind of sense of, am I not compromising my authority to the students by, you know, interacting in ways that show that they have expertise that I don't have. And so I think in different school systems, we either promote that more effectively or constrain it by the way that we see teacher roles and student roles.
Well, it's interesting because there does seem to be something human about thinking of things in opposition to one another. It's this or that, when they may not be mutually exclusive. Now, maybe we can enter into a kind of co-construction and retain the authority of the teacher in the classroom. But you said something earlier about the way in which we understand often your progress or your acquisition of the English language is something that will mark your academic success progress. And yet you've done a lot of work with families and with schools in fleshing out a linguistic profile for younger children, because we also know that maintaining the first language is an indicator of later academic success. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there are kind of two different things at play there. When I mentioned the research that shows that proficiency in English is the strongest predictor of academic success, that's from UK-based research on the Bell Assessment Framework and the links between proficiency in English and success at GCSE and A-levels. And so that's a very particular kind of statistic. And it's linked to the fact that the definition of EAL, English as Additional Language, in England is very vague. It's students who are exposed to a language other than English in the home or in the community. And so it doesn't tell you anything about their proficiency at all. And so within that EAL label, you'll have children who are completely fluent in English. You'll have children who are fluent in another language and learning English and everything in between. And so that particular piece of data does show that the stronger their proficiency in English, the better they do in their English exams. But there is no measure in there of how they do otherwise, how they do in terms of social emotional development, how they do in terms of their own language development. It's strictly about the relationship to English GCSEs and A-levels. And so it's a reductive lens, if you will. It tells us one piece about that student in terms of their academic outcomes, but it doesn't tell us a lot of other things, like, are they finishing school bilingual? Have they taken their own language with them all the way through? Can they read it, write it, work in it? Or have they left their own language behind in the quest for English? And so when we work with schools kind of from the ground up, building linguistic profiles with families and pathways, it's to help everybody understand that the goal for any one child is not just to be Englished as quickly as possible. The goal should be for every child to have the possibility to become bilingual. And we spend a lot of time and energy talking about how do we teach languages better. A lot of, you know, discussion about the Key Stage 2 guidelines and the Key Stage 3 guidelines and, you know, lowering uptake on GCSEs and A-levels for language. And what we're missing is that whole wealth of languages that are out there that are not currently being supported very well in schools. And so it's, you know, that visibility of other languages needs to become much more present for us to focus more on the holistic profile of the child and their ultimate outcomes in terms of both their languages and their academic success, rather than just that one marker of a particular version of academic success, which is what we tend to focus on.
Earlier this morning, you were mentioning changes in Ofsted in relation to English language learners. Can you flesh that out for us a bit?
I mean, I think it's incredibly interesting. It remains to be seen how those expectations are going to be feasible. The whole area around English as an additional language has been marginalized in the UK for a very long time, which means there's been no teacher training programs, ITE programs included if they feel like it. It's not been part of the core ITE framework. And so actually EAL expertise in England is very, very limited. Most of the people who are in any way kind of really trained and qualified are women of my age, a certain age, who did their education at a time when you could do qualifications in EAL. And so there's a whole gap of kind of 20 years where nobody's been able to actually specialize in it in England. And so the new expectations from Ofsted are, I would call them specifically vague or vaguely specific. It's great that it's there. They are recognizing that, you know, language profiles and students with EAL, we have to think about inclusion, we have to think about belonging, we have to think about equity and access to learning. All of those things are now there in what schools can be asked to determine, but without the underlying build through initial teacher education and ongoing teacher education. And, you know, now we need a lot of in-service teacher education. I'm not sure how schools are supposed to all of a sudden pivot to having this deep knowledge base that allows them to provide the evidence that Ofsted could now be looking for in terms of the, you know, the criteria around students with English as an additional language. And so there's going to be a lot of messiness as it develops, where schools are looking probably quite desperately for, you know, resources and support. And and it's still, it's quite thin on the ground. So at the University of Oxford, they launched an online PGDIP EAL in September 2025. It's the first qualification in EAL in the English market in quite some time. And so that's kind of prompting, you know, other universities, I'm sure, to start looking at it. But if you think about kind of the, you know, the business model of stock and flow, what do we do to increase the flow of teachers into the system that have better understanding of students who are developing English and multilingual students? Those are not always the same thing. But also, what do we do with the stock of teachers who have been trained in the last 20 years and haven't had, you know, the professional development that they need to understand how to provision for these students well? And also the question about, you know, the Ofsted inspectors may not even themselves know what good looks like because they haven't been looking for it for quite some time. When I did my work with Jersey several years ago on the language policy, the way the Jersey system works is when they do school reviews, they have a local team and they bring in one Ofsted inspector as an external. And in one of the schools they were reviewing in the last year of the project after the launch of the language policy, the Ofsted inspector was amazed and impressed about their level of practice to do, you know, around inclusion for multilingual learners and learners with English as an additional language, because it's not something that they had had experience of in their kind of tenure as an Ofsted inspector here, which is not to say there aren't pockets of good practice in England. There absolutely are. But it's down to determination of a particular school team and their own knowledge building rather than any system support that they were given.
Well, I can imagine all kinds of exciting projects that one could engage in, initial teacher education and continuing professional development. And maybe we can come up with some ideas. But I'd like to turn the conversation a little bit toward something you just mentioned, inclusion, belonging. These are big words in the discourse on education these days. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But I would love to hear how you place looking at multilingualism in the context of an education for social justice. How do you see that?
I think, from my perspective, I look at it through two lenses, access and engagement. So every student deserves the right to equity in accessing learning and in being assessed fairly. And so that's looking at their language profile, understanding where they are in their development of English, understanding how to use their own languages effectively for learning where their English is still in development. So leveraging both our growing expertise and understanding how to provide good English language support, but also our growing expertise in how multilingualism itself can be an asset for access for learning. And so I think access is one piece, and the other piece is engagement, and that's really the belonging piece. Do students see themselves in the curriculum? Do they feel that their perspectives are represented? Do they feel like what they have to bring to the table has equal value to the kind of normative cultural standards of the curriculum that they're in? And that's a piece that is work that needs to be done through the lens of multilingualism. So just to give you an example, we talk about teaching Shakespeare a lot. And I work with a lot of international schools that do, you know, British curricula. And so they do Shakespeare. And if you think about the, you know, the roots of Shakespeare and how we interpret it in modern times, it's very much through the lens of what society was like at that time in this place. And so if you look at Macbeth, it's a very particular play about a very particular social context. And there are things in that play that are perhaps not transparent or accessible to students who don't come from that cultural background. And that can even be students in the UK who are 100% English monolingual, but just don't have the, you know, the cultural background. But one of the things I've done in many of these schools is we take the witches in Macbeth. So the witches in Macbeth have a really important role to play that is beyond their actual role as witches. And we kind of see them as pointy black-hatted witches. And to people from our particular cultural background, when we see a pointy black-hatted witch, we know what the implication is. But if you come from a completely different culture, those pointy black-hatted witches maybe don't mean anything to you. And so one of the richness aspects of bringing multilingualism to the classroom is if you've got kids from lots of different backgrounds, you get them to go and find a portrayal of Macbeth in their own language and bring to the class, how are the witches portrayed? And what do we learn from that? So there's a really famous Japanese version from a very long time ago. It's not three witches, it's one forest spirit. Mm-hmm. Because that's what makes the role of the witches meaningful in Japanese culture or in Japanese culture at that time. And so, you know, looking beyond the, can they speak English well enough to read Macbeth? It's how would we enrich our understandings of Macbeth by taking a multilingual, multicultural lens? And I think that that's the push around social justice and belonging, where we can move away from a single narrative of what something means and really inquire deeply about other people's perspectives and what it might look like. And you know, it's cross-curricular. If you have 10 students all research what caused World War I in 10 different languages, you're going to get 10 slightly different stories. So there's a richness in that learning then. Who's right? Who's wrong? If we're reading different things. And so I think there's the piece around, you know, belonging and visibility in the curriculum itself through the lens of, are we reading writers that look like our students? Are they seeing themselves in those? But there's also just the work we can do with students for them to go and find out from their own perspective and bring it into the classroom and make the learning more meaningful for everyone. And I think that's the piece that we underestimate. A lot of times teachers go into work on multilingualism thinking that we're doing this for the kids who are multilingual. But actually, it brings as much, if not more, to the kids who are monolingual, because they are getting different perspectives as well and different ways of viewing the world. And they're learning about other languages. And so they become more engaged and more interested simply because they're learning from their peers.
And because for many of them, these things are becoming more relevant.
Absolutely.
Something with which they can connect. Sounds pretty exciting to me.
It is. And I think there are really great opportunities within the UK to do that kind of deep work that don't require any teacher expertise whatsoever. So we talk a lot about, you know, kids aren't very interested in languages and they don't really want to learn them. But if you've got a group of kids in a rural primary school in the Black Country and you're trying to teach them French, they don't really see most of them the relevance or the applicability. When am I ever going to go to France? But if you kind of take a lens on who lives with them and among them and who are their friends and what languages do they speak, you can get a lot more interest and curiosity around how languages work by really just tapping into local resources rather than always thinking about languages are, you know, modern foreign languages and we teach these four. If to our kids those aren't meaningful, they're not going to be motivated language learners. And then they'll lose out on the opportunity for, you know, the linguistic widening, the opportunity for, you know, empowerment and engagement in languages themselves, just because the language we're offering them doesn't feel relevant to them.
I think I have just one last thing I want to ask you about today, although we could talk for a long time about a lot of things. But as you were speaking, I was thinking also about assessment. And you were saying something about, you know, children being able to demonstrate their learning using their other language. And that is also something that is challenging for teachers. If you had a vision for really best practice in terms of assessment, how children demonstrate learning, what might be a part of that vision?
It will vary by age and stage, but I think the common principle is you always have to stop and ask, what is it I want to know? And with this child, given their profile, what's the best way to find that out? So if you want to know if they understand how ecosystems work, you can find that out in any language. If you want to know, can they write a summary of an ecosystem in English, then that's the piece you have to find out in English. But we can separate those out. Knowledge is not language specific. Knowledge is transferable. And so a child can learn about something in their own language, be assessed on their knowledge in their own language, and then get help in being able to do that in English. And the learning is much more powerful than if we've given them only the English resources and they haven't learned it very well. And then in the assessment, they do poorly, partly because they haven't learned it well and also because their English is not where it needs to be. And so it's always separating out what's the purpose of assessment. If this assessment is to find out knowledge or skill that is language agnostic, we can find that out in any language. And then the piece is then, how do I as a teacher help the child build the capacity to do the thing in English that they did in their own language for that assessment? And so it absolutely varies by age and stage. But one of the things we need to recognize is if that we are mediating all assessment through English all the way up. And so if you look at the Bell Assessment Framework, there are five bands of proficiency, A, B, C, D, E, all the way up through band D. Their proficiency in English will impact how they perform on that assessment. And so we're not actually a lot of the time assessing what we think we're assessing. We're simply assessing their ability either to learn it in English or to produce evidence of their learning in English. And that's unfair. But also, we end up underestimating significantly students' intellectual capacities because of the language piece of the assessment. And so we do know, the data shows very clearly, that there is a strong tendency to place students who are still learning English in lowest set math. Why? Well, because it's going to be easier for them. But what if they're really mathematically strong and actually putting them in that class is going to do them damage? We need to make sure that we're not conflating level of English with academic potential in any area of the subject, because that is something that happens a lot and undermines their sense of belonging, undermines equity in accessing education, undermines their motivation, and makes them feel unseen because they know that everybody's viewing them through a deficit lens of the things they can't do in English rather than the things that they can do.
That was that you used the word deficit. It kept ringing in my brain as you were speaking, and how it really essential it is, I think, for us to be aware of, to try and catch ourselves in making assumptions and in engaging in deficit language that reflects deficit thinking, so that we're not actually seeing the child or seeing the learning as they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hear that in schools all the time. Somebody will say to me, oh, that child has no language. Actually, you mean that they're still developing English? I'm pretty sure they have a language, but we use it as a shorthand. But that shorthand reinforces our own kind of internal perceptions of the students. And it's the same when we use the term EAL. Oh, that child is EAL. What does that mean? It means they're learning English as an additional language. But actually, the characteristic of the child is they are multilingual. EAL is a temporary state and perhaps a provision, but it shouldn't be the label that we use, because what happens is then, when the child is no longer EAL, we lose sight of their other key characteristic, which is they are multilingual. That in and of itself needs attention explicitly in education to give them the best outcomes, regardless of if they are now fluent enough in English that they can pass as not EAL anymore.
Someone we both know, Kristen Pelletier, has done some wonderful sessions in schools that I have seen where the title is Address the Need, Not the Label. And I think that's a really important reminder for us. And those labels have changed over time. there's EAL and there's ELA and there's ELL and there's, and so we want to treat the need and not the label, and yet we need terminology. What's the terminology that you would prefer these days?
So I think for me, it's separating out the characteristic of the child. So a child is a multilingual learner if they speak a language beyond the school language in any way, shape, and form. And that's a permanent characteristic. You come into school as a Portuguese speaker, you are labeled and you're learning English, so you're labeled as a multilingual learner, and that's permanent. EAL for me is not a need, it's not a support, it's a provision. Because again, when we talk about need and support, we feel like this is a thing we're doing for these kids. When actually, if you're taking kids into your school who don't speak the school language, you have to provision for them to learn it. In the same way you support other kids in English literacy or learning other languages. And so it's just a part of school provision. And so multilingual learners are a permanent characteristic. English as an additional language is a provision that some multilingual learners will access in order to develop their English to the level they need to access the curriculum. We can sort those two out. Whether we use EAL, ELA, ELL, honestly, it doesn't matter as long as it's the provision and not the child. That's what's most important.
And you're saying multilingualism, a child is a Portuguese speaker, comes into a school where the language of instruction is English. Why multilingual and not bilingual?
Because how do we count languages? You know, I speak English fluently, French fluently, pretty good Dutch. Am I bilingual with a bit of Dutch or am I multilingual? You know, we certainly in the field of applied linguistics, we've moved away from the idea of being able to count languages because then we feel like we have to measure them against the CEFR to count them. And I don't count this one because I have an accent, or I don't count that one because I don't have enough of it. And so I would say by and large, we now use the term multilingual as a as an overarching category of two languages or more. Within Europe, and the kind of the way they use it, is they talk about plurilingual individuals. So plurilingual meaning you have different languages, which recognizes that they might not be fluent. I find plurilingual makes people stop and go, what? So I just use multilingual, and you'll see in the research, multilingual and bilingual are interchangeable. But it's recognizing that for most kids, if they have two, they also have parts of others. Not all, but it just makes it easier than saying bi slash multilingual or bilingual or multilingual.
All right. Well, before we close, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you would like to share with our listeners?
Oh, that's a big question to just throw out at the end. I think what I would encourage people to do is to A, do a little bit of research for themselves on the value of multilingualism if they don't feel that they are comfortable and knowledgeable. The vast majority of teachers in schools in the UK, the vast majority, in some of the outlying areas less, but you know, one in five children in English primary schools have English as an additional language. That's a big statistic, actually. And so most people will be interacting with these kids as teachers, and knowing enough to not base your practice on rumor, hearsay, something somebody once told you is really powerful as teachers to understand how you can really give these students the best opportunity within your classes and your schools. And that's really important. And then also just building professional communities, because there has been a really big gap in England around, you know, both kind of knowledge development and teacher development in this area. And so teachers might feel that they don't have the knowledge or skills, but there's probably somebody on your staff who has worked somewhere where it was a kind of more of a key part of their practice. And so just, you know, look around and find those people and figure out how you can make your school feel inclusive for all of your students, wherever their backgrounds are from and whatever languages they speak. Because if we make it feel inclusive for our children, we'll also make it feel inclusive for their families.
So maybe we'd like to close and say that there are a lot of resources, and maybe mention the Oxford Collaborative for Multilingual Education, which you have established with colleagues, and which is a remarkable source for understanding about multilingual learners.
Yeah, I think we're in the very early phases of the work we do, but the idea behind the collaborative is to bring together, all of us are practitioner researchers. And so we are all teachers at our heart, and many of us still teach in different ways, but we all also have a academic background. And so we're really trying to promote the idea of the links between research and into classrooms and schools, and make that something that's much more accessible for other people to find. And then also build outward facing links for schools that are trying to figure out what to do now, and make it kind of easy for them to come and find, well, you know, there's a great resource that was created by school teachers in England called WALLO, World of Languages, Languages mm-hmm. of the World. It's the most amazing resource for teaching kids about languages. Every school should be using it. It's free. We can direct you to it. We, you know, you don't need to pay anybody anything to use it. And it's really transformative in schools. There's the WAMCAM, We Are Multilingual Cambridge, which is another great free program that schools can use to help their kids tune into multilingualism. There's Roots into Languages Cymru, which is teaching resources for languages. There are all kinds of great things that people have difficulty finding. And so one of the things we hope to do is be able to provide a resource base where people can come and go, this is what I'm looking for, and that's what I want to do with it. Because there's not really a cohesive system for people to find things.
Well, it sounds wonderful. And I guess we'll close our conversation for now, but I just want to thank you again for coming here and sharing your thoughts and your wisdom and expertise, as always, with us. So thank you, Eowyn.
Thank you for having me.
Please leave a comment, ask a question, and like, follow, and subscribe to hear more from Bridge Ed. You can also follow The Bridge on LinkedIn, and you can find out more information on our website at thebridge.wellingtoncollege.org.uk. Until next time.